Hello and welcome to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar, and it is such a pleasure to be with you this evening. So later on in the show, coming up is Suzanne Giesemann. Suzanne is a retired U.S. Navy commander. She served as a commanding officer and as a special assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations and aide to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on 9/11. She was in the Pentagon at the time of the explosion on 9/11. She has stories to share about that, but she is now an evidential medium. She was once a skeptic and now has found answers to the questions that she has asked herself since those experiences she had on 9/11. She's written a new book called Messages of Hope. So that's Suzanne Giesemann. She will be joining me later on tonight. First, we are going to be talking about fake food. Fish is one of the most frequently faked foods Americans can buy. 99% of Kobe beef sold in the U.S. is fake. 100% Parmesan cheese that is sold in the bottles there is actually cut with everything from cheaper cheeses to wood pulp. We're going to find out how our government is complicit in the fake food racket with Larry Olmsted when we come back. He is an extreme U.S. journalist. He was voted one of the top most extreme U.S. journalists. Larry is, and we'll be speaking with him when we come back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Lisa Gar. So you've seen the headlines possibly where it says Parmesan cheese is made from sawdust, or lobster rolls don't contain lobster at all. Or maybe you've heard about extra virgin olive oil that isn't olive oil. So these are the fake foods that are in our supermarkets, they're in our restaurants, they're in our kitchen. And we don't necessarily know about this because it is an unregulated industry. For the most part, a lot of the labeling, common food labeling, is a complete scam. And some of our own government agencies have either lost their funding to continue to do research on this or continue to do investigations on this. And it's up to us to learn a lot more. So someone has done this for us. Larry Olmsted, he was named one of the most 10 top most extreme U.S. journalists by the Society of Professional Journalists. His expose on counterfeit Kobe beef for Forbes.com was widely covered by newspapers and websites and radio shows. And he has written a new book called Real Food, Fake Food: Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what your interest was, first of all, in writing a book like this.
Well, I've been writing as a journalist on travel and food topics for over 20 years, you know, for newspapers and magazines all around the world. So I've traveled a great deal and gotten to eat a lot of interesting things. And when I travel, I always make it a point to try to eat, you know, whatever the specialty is in the places I go, what the people eat, what the place is known for. And, you know, when you do that, you occasionally have something really good, really memorable. And I would come back from these trips and then try to replicate it or order the same thing here in the U.S. And a lot of the times I was very disappointed. I would go and, you know, have something like Kobe beef in Japan and then come back and try to order it here. And it never looked or tasted right, and I wondered about that. So when I started to research it, I realized that the reason it didn't look or taste right was because it wasn't the real thing, and that this problem was much more pervasive than I would have thought. So that sort of set me down the road on writing this book.
So, how did you discover 99.9% of Kobe beef in the U.S. that's sold in the U.S. is fake?
Well, I mean, at the time that I started, it was 100%.
Oh, really?
Because you know, so I went to Japan and I had Kobe beef, and not only does it, you know, taste very different, but it looks very different even before it's cooked. You know, now I can sort of look at a steak and tell whether it's, you know, Japanese beef or not. And so when I came back here, I would go to, you know, nice steakhouses around the country or even local restaurants. There was sort of this epidemic of Kobe burgers and Kobe sliders, and like I said, I was always disappointed. So when I looked into it, I found fairly quickly that the importation of Japanese beef was banned by the USDA, unconditionally, in every form, frozen, fresh, whole, ground. no Japanese beef whatsoever arriving in the United States, and this was just over 4 years ago. So every restaurant in the country claiming to serve Kobe beef was basically lying to its customers. That has changed. Now the importation of Kobe beef is legal, but there are currently 10 restaurants in the entire United States serving the real thing. And
only 10.
Only 10. Exactly 10.
So that food truck rolling down the street that says Kobe beef burgers is not really the real thing. Well, first of all, why did they ban it in the U.S. in the first place?
It's actually, Japanese beef has been banned and then unbanned and banned again and unbanned. And it's in recent history been because of outbreaks of hoof and mouth disease. So, you know, it's not uncommon, and it's not just Japan. I mean, the USDA and the FDA routinely ban temporarily the imports of products from different parts of the world due to safety concerns. But in that case, you know, it's the importation of Japanese beef was banned for the majority of the 21st century.
Wine from other countries, yes. Food, I don't know. I mean, beef, I don't know. So what is Wagyu beef?
So Wagyu is the sort
Wagyu.
Of catch-all term for the indigenous breeds of Japanese cattle. And there's five different breeds that fall under the name Wagyu, but they're all pretty similar. You know, for our purposes, you know, you can think of Wagyu like Scotch whiskey. You know, there's differences within it, but it's one category of a particular product. And Kobe beef is just a regional form of Wagyu. You know, it's a Wagyu that's raised under certain rules in the area around Kobe City. Like a lot of foreign specialty foods and American specialty foods like Kona coffee, you know, it's named for the place it comes from. And Wagyu, there's a lot of other famous and highly respected Japanese beef that just hasn't gotten the cachet of Kobe in this country, and all of those would be Wagyu. So Wagyu is even more mysterious to the American consumer because there are Wagyu bred cattle or breed cattle being raised here in the United States that are very similar to those in Japan, and there's Wagyu breed cattle being raised here in the States that are very dissimilar to those in Japan, and then there's a lot of product in restaurants called Wagyu that has nothing whatsoever to do with Japanese breeds. So it's kind of a crapshoot. It can be very real, very fake.
So why is this not a regulated industry where menus and labeling such as organic and so forth is not more controlled?
Well, there's a variety of problems. So, you know, at the top, there's foods that are just counterfeit. So they are regulated, but it doesn't really matter, you know, which would be, you know, say, you know, like buying a counterfeit Rolex or Gucci bag in the street. You know, it's clearly illegal, but it's not really well enforced, which is why people, you know, in Chinatown in New York City can stand on the street with a table mm-hmm. and sell those things. Everybody knows it's illegal, but it's not a high priority for law enforcement. Then there's, you know, the USDA and the FDA both have, you know, some sort of serious lapses in their labeling standards. They might have a definition of something, but it's so broad as to be meaningless, or they often choose not to define things. The perfect example would be natural. The FDA has intentionally and repeatedly chosen not to define the term natural. So by not defining it, there's no legal standard, which means you can't really break a law or violate anything by calling something natural. So many of the foods we buy today in the supermarket,
it's on everything, yes,
are labeled natural, which is meaningless.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, there's the restaurant issue, which is, this is the one that surprised a lot of readers of my book. I mean, surprised me when I researched it. The restaurants, you know, are not subject to the same labeling rules as retailers. Those FDA and USDA laws that apply to your box of cereal do not apply to the restaurant menu. So it's sort of the Wild West when you go into a restaurant. They make claims on the menu all the time that are just, you know, outright lies, and nobody holds them accountable.
So you've done a lot of this research for us. Let's talk about fish. And you say that sushi is one of the world's worst real food choices that you could make in America. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, seafood is probably the most fraud-ridden category. And then within the restaurant industry, of all the different sort of specialty niches, sushi would be the one that I've seen the most fraud in. And with all of the fake food, there's sort of a recurring theme that when when you can't, you know, look at a product and easily tell what it is, you're more subject to fraud. And, you know, so a real, I'm sure you remember a couple of years ago, there was a lot of publicity where there was this big horse meat scandal in Europe where, you know, the British and other Europeans found out that a lot of their frozen food, like beef lasagna, was actually horse meat. And that didn't affect us in our country, but the reason it worked is because when you buy like a frozen lasagna, you can't look at it and tell what kind of meat is in it. It could be horse, it could be beef, you can't really tell. And that's how it is with a lot of sushi, especially, you know, in our country, people eat a lot of rolls where, you know, the piece of fish that you're looking at is like, you know, the diameter of a pencil eraser, and it's wrapped in rice that's heavily flavored with vinegar and seaweed. So you don't really, can't really see that, you know, so-called tuna. You can't hardly taste that so-called tuna, whereas if you had like a tuna steak, you'd actually see some of the fish. So, you know, sushi really lends itself to that because the fish is so disguised already when you're served. And in whitefish in particular, which is why seafood is such a big problem, most people cannot tell one whitefish from another once it's been cut up. Red snapper, which is very expensive, but also the single most substituted fish in this country and in sushi restaurants as well, looks just like tilapia, which is much, much cheaper. So anytime you have two things that look the same and you can sell it for a high price but substitute a cheap version, there's going to be fraud.
What about the differences between tilapia and red snapper and some of these other white fishes? Are there any that are highly toxic that we should definitely not be eating?
Well, probably the worst that's sort of readily available would be escalar. Its nickname in the seafood industry is the Ex-Lax of the sea. Without getting too graphic, it's prone to giving people digestive distress. And that's because of a naturally occurring wax in this fish. And it's a fish that's been frequently substituted for tuna in sushi restaurants in particular. And, you know, the irony here is, you know, we got our love of sushi from Japan. Japan has some of the best food safety standards in the world, and in Japan, this particular fish, escalar, has been banned for 40 years because it's not good for you. In our country, it's legal. It's not something you would ever, and that's true of a lot of the fish that are substituted. You're never going to hear of your friends going down to the fish market and saying, "Hey, give me a pound of escalar."
Right.
You know, these fish are imported really specifically to be substituted for other fish and rip people off.
I see. So that the white fish is not a good idea. Of course, not doing rolls is a good idea. Okay, we've learned that. But what about salmon? So can salmon really be wild caught? And is it usually wild caught from Alaska? Is it better fine in streams? Or is it really all farmed? Or most of it?
Well, a lot of the, I mean, about 40% of the seafood that we consume today worldwide is farmed. Aquaculture is big. It's here to stay. It's part of the future of, you know, trying to feed a world that's going to be 10, 12, you know, 15 billion people. Aquaculture across the board is not bad, just like raising cattle is not bad, but it can be done very badly and has been done very badly for the most part. It's improving, and I've certainly seen fish farms and salmon farms that do a really good job, but I don't think most of them do. And so a lot of the salmon we get is farmed, and probably the biggest misconception for consumers is when they see Atlantic salmon. And you can go into a lot of supermarkets in this country and you'll see, you know, a sign that says fresh Atlantic salmon. Mm-hmm. And that's literally true. It's fresh and it's Atlantic salmon. But what most people don't know is that all Atlantic salmon is farmed. Atlantic salmon is commercially extinct in the wild. So when you see the words Atlantic salmon, that's synonymous with farm, but it might not say that because people don't want to pay top dollar for farm salmon, so they don't advertise it. Almost all of the wild-caught salmon that we consume in the United States comes from Alaska, and it's delicious. I only buy wild-caught salmon. Not only do I think it tastes better, But it's, you know, it's wild caught, which means it's not raised on antibiotics and with vaccines and a lot of the products that are used in fish farming. It eats a natural diet, which the fish eats, which does not do in a fish farm. And also the waters in Alaska are, you know, unusually clean. They're very closely monitored, and the fish is fantastic. The problem is it's more expensive. It's seasonal. And it's often defrauded because, again, I said when something looks the same but you can get a cheaper version, there's going to be fraud. So in supermarket studies, about 20% of the time people have bought what's advertised as wild-caught salmon for a higher price. It's actually farm salmon.
Ooh.
And in restaurants, it's more like a third of the time or more. It's been as high as two-thirds, depending where they do the studies. So, you know, it's
How would you
the
know, though? I mean, is it less, is it pinker in color? And when it says color added, does that mean that it's most likely the farmed salmon?
No, I guess the wild is actually sort of redder,
Oh,
or
yeah.
it's darker, and it's really hard to tell just looking at one. It's easier when they're side by side. So when you go to the supermarket, and a lot of times they'll have wild caught, what says wild caught salmon for one price, say, you know, $23 a pound, and next to it farm salmon that's cheaper, $16 a pound. They should not look exactly the same. If they look exactly the same, that's a bad sign. Farm salmon tends to be very regular in shape and size because the fish are more consistent. All the steaks, say, in a row in the supermarket will look pretty similar. There's more variation in the wild caught, and it is one of the fish that experienced seafood buyers and industry people can tell apart by looking. Chefs, it's hard for the average person, whereas even people in the seafood industry have a lot of trouble telling apart the whitefish. The good news about salmon is, for the most part, you know, it looks different from all the other fish. So when you buy salmon, at least you're usually getting salmon. You're not going to get tilapia or escalar or swai or one of the common counterfeits. Though there have been, the one fish that does look like salmon is steelhead trout from Chile, and there have been cases of that being passed off in restaurants. There was a case in Florida of a distributor being fined millions of dollars for importing Chilean steelhead trout and relabeling it salmon. So, you know, it's the fake food industry is a $50 billion a year industry, and it's very similar to the drug, you know, the narcotics business, in that there's, you know, small scale players and there's large organized players. Organized crime is involved.
Wow.
The main difference is that it's really hard to go to jail for smuggling or
Shrimp,
adulterating
right?
food.
Yes,
So, you know,
absolutely.
it's a
Well,
better business to be in than heroin.
I mean, but the drugs that are in these fish, I mean, the shrimp specifically, I was reading your book and it was talking about the shrimp that had unapproved drugs, but you mentioned the vaccines, the hormones, the chemicals that are in these farmed shrimp. And that the FDA basically has this as a very low priority and devotes minimal resources to discovering any type of regulation on this or monitoring the shipments. It's all very, as you said, it's all very sketchy, but isn't the FDA responsible for making our food safe? Isn't that the whole point of it?
They are, and especially when it comes to seafood, unlike most of the other categories, certainly of protein that we eat, you know, beef, pork, chicken, almost all of our seafood is imported. Over 90% of the seafood we consume in the United States is imported. Whereas, you know, for very little of our beef is imported, and when we do import beef, it's something like Kobe beef that's you know, a specialty that we think is even better. The seafood that we import is not better for the most part than our domestic seafood. The irony here is, you know, we have great fisheries in the United States, Alaska, the Gulf of Mexico. Some of our fish command top dollar in the international market. So what happens is, we export it to countries like Japan that are willing to pay top dollar for, say, Alaskan fish, and then we import. Instead of that, we import really cheap farm fish from Southeast Asia, And shrimp in particular, which you mentioned, has a really bad track record of being farmed under suspect and criminal circumstances. And then, for example, the FDA banned the import of shrimp from Japan, from China, because of these banned drugs. So the Chinese producers just send it to a third-party country like India or Malaysia and relabel it as a product of there to get around the rules. It's called transshipping, and it happens a lot with food. The FDA has just recently started to really step up their investigation of imported seafood, and this is because in 2014,
Wait one
well,
sec. We actually need to learn about this because I also want to find out what's going on with the fast food industry and what exactly that fish is. When we come back, my guest is Larry Olmsted. The book is called Real Food, Fake Food. We will be right back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Hello, this is Lisa Gar, and my guest today is tonight, Larry Olmsted. We're talking about fake food. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about why the governments do not regulate this industry more, why terms like organic and natural and free range and even extra virgin don't actually mean anything because they're not enforced, and how this could apply to everything that we're eating. It's not just the Kobe beef and the fish, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the Parmesan cheese and the olive oil. It is everything else that you eat. It's coffee, it's the flavorings in coffee, like the pumpkin spice racket. There's a huge industry on some of these spices. Champagne, honey, all sorts of things. But then we're going to find out what the independent state governments are doing to bypass the feds to actually make food safer, and what third label parties you can trust better than government standards. So we will be back with all that information with Larry Olmsted when we come back. This is Lisa Gar, you're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar, and my guest is Larry Olmsted. We're talking about real food, fake food, and that's the name of his book. So can we talk a little? You mentioned the fish industry before we were going to the break. When you go to a fast food restaurant, or when someone goes to a fast food restaurant, and they see fish on the menu. I was actually, my daughter was looking at an Instagram thing earlier today, and it was journaling the oil in a fast food restaurant, saying the first day that the batch of oil is used, it's usually like a yellow color, and then they said you can't add the chicken until the third day, and then you can't add the fish until the second week. And by the time that batch of oil is done, it could be used to basically go into your car. It's thick black oil. And this is what food is cooked in that's coming through our fast food chains. It's not only the food, but it's the process in which they fry these foods in the same oil for weeks. Do you know anything about this?
Well, it's tough to paint the whole fast food industry with a broad brush. Obviously fast food gets a bad name, but it's a big industry with a lot of different players. I've seen, I write this column for USA Today called Great American Bites, which focuses on, some of the country's best sort of road food, hole in the wall, restaurants, the kind of places you'd stop if you were road tripping across the country. And I've been to a number of these sort of, famous seafood shacks, clam shacks, in the coast of New England, places like that, and the South on the Atlantic coast. And the ones that stand out as being excellent and being acclaimed, one of the things they all have in common is they always talk about how often they change their oil. Sometimes, I've been to seafood shacks that change the oil 4 times a day in the fryers. That's a lot for the industry. But I don't know what the standards are for, McDonald's or Burger King or the big chains in terms of, and I'm sure they do have standards because they have standards for everything, in terms of how often they change that oil.
So, but it's not regulated again, though, other than the independent chain.
No, I assume that the 'cause most of the cleanliness type issues for restaurants are regulated at the state level. And that can be very, very different. But I went to a sort of a chef's boot camp recently, an industry event, where chefs from around the country were talking about how different the local inspection laws are. So in some states, most states have a rule on basically once you open a package of something, how quickly you have to use it up. And that varied tremendously from like 3 days to 2 weeks, depending on the state.
Really? What about the restaurant ratings, like the A, B, C? Do you have any information on that in terms of if it's bought and paid for or if it's legit?
Well, it is regulated, but again, it's at the local level, not even the state level, the municipality. So, you know, New York City is pretty famous because they instituted this a few years ago, and there's those big letters in the window, mm-hmm. AB, I don't know if they have a C. You know, what happens once you fail?
Yeah, I know.
C. That's different in New York City than it is in, you know, other parts of New York State, let alone the rest of the country. So, you know, it's very variable around the country. And, you know, give people an idea, the one issue that's been talked about lately is the expiration date on milk. You know, you go to buy a quart of milk, it has a date on it, used by date. Now, there's no kind of scientific standard or anything for, you know, when milk is no longer good. Every state sort of takes a guess at it. And of the 50 states, we have 41 different standards for how to label that milk. And in some states, you know, milk is thrown out when it's perfectly good. In other states, it might be on the shelf for too long. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of just things that have always been done a certain way that are guesswork and have, you know, no science behind them.
How come it's not federally regulated? It's state regulated.
It just depends on, you know, well, whether it's an issue of interstate commerce. So, you know, if you know, like I live in Vermont, most of the milk on the shelves that I see is produced in Vermont or in a, you know, nearby state. So it doesn't have to cross a state border. But I think, you know, a lot comes down to the issue of big government versus local government. A lot of consumers want more regulation at the local level. And in some way, that's not a bad thing. I mean, we see with some of the food labeling, states have stricter laws that preempt the federal government's laws. It's not a matter of, you know, whether local or federal is better. It's a matter of the specific rule.
Well, but what's the difference between the federal government regulating prescription drugs and supplements and vitamins? Why don't they have that same philosophy around food, which is also essentially medicine?
Well, hey, I agree with you. I mean, the FDA, you know, they're the Food and Drug Administration, and they seem to devote a lot more resources to the pharmaceutical side, though mm-hmm. I would argue that food is the most important drug we take.
Right.
We take it
mm-hmm.
every day, whether or not you need a prescription. I mean, the FDA does regulate a lot of foods, and so does the USDA at the, you know, federal level, but it's not all, they don't regulate restaurants and cleanliness, but they regulate most of the actual product. So, you know, wherever you buy a box of cereal, it doesn't matter what state, what supermarket, it's got to have that nutrition panel and list of ingredients that's mandated by the FDA. A lot of health claims on products are mandated by the FDA. As a matter of fact, they just came out with new recommendations for what, you know, manufacturers can use the word healthy itself on food. And then the USDA is responsible for almost all of our meat and egg labeling, the grading. So when you go to buy a steak and it says, you know, prime, choice, select, the
grade A,
meat, you know, that's done by the USDA. And that's something that they actually do, you know, a really good job at. I think both agencies fail in a lot of respects, but they do certain things well. One example that's important is with any kind of food illness outbreak. You know, we hear of a particular fast food chain mm-hmm. serving some meat that, you know, makes everybody sick. They crack down on that very quickly. They know what slaughterhouse or where, or if it's lettuce, you know, whatever the product is, where it came from, what lot. They're able to trace and contain those outbreaks very quickly. That's something the government devotes a lot of resources to, as opposed to, say, inspecting our seafood.
So the USDA, the difference between that and the FDA is that the USDA is the one that promotes and that regulates the food producers, not necessarily the public, right? Not necessarily the consumer, right?
Well, really just the agricultural producers. So, typically if it's an animal product, any kind of just meat, it's regulated by the USDA. If it's a processed food like a cereal or soup or something on the shelf, it's usually the FDA. So a lot more foods are under the auspices of the FDA, if you just think of the aisles of the supermarket. But the stuff that comes from the farm, for the most part, is the USDA. And the biggest example there is the USDA is the one that's in charge of the organic labeling program for produce, for everything except seafood.
Is there a difference between natural and organic?
Legally, for sure. Like I said, natural means nothing. On a label, you should really just ignore it. Assume that, it's attempt to deceive you. It's really, really, literally meaningless. Organic has a very defined legal meaning, and there are, people who find fault with the organic rules. And if you dive into them, there's some fertilizers and pesticides and practices allowed that people would say, well, that shouldn't be called organic. But I think, compared to a lot of government regulation, overall, the organic rules are pretty good. When you buy something, especially produce or meat labeled organic, meat's a great example. I don't want antibiotics in my meat. It's that simple. That's something I personally try to avoid. If you buy meat labeled organic, it won't have antibiotics in it, and that's sort of good enough for me. The problem is, most meat isn't organic.
What about free range? What does that mean, really?
That's pretty much meaningless. There is a definition of it when they raise these chickens in these huge overcrowded barns, and to call it free range or free roaming, they have to allow the chickens access to the outdoors. And what that means is that they put in the equivalent of like a dog door, a little door that the chickens could theoretically walk out. But the way that they're raised from birth, and the way that they're trained, and the way that they're raised, they don't do that. They never use that door. So it's like a theoretical. Free range means they could have gone outside, but they didn't actually do it. And there's a lot of terms. I mentioned natural, pasture raised, pasture finished, grass fed, no animal byproducts, free range, free roaming, green fed, humane. That are slapped on our food, all of which, are meaningless.
Interesting. All right. Well, speaking of labeling, what about GMOs? Do you have any updates on the labeling of genetically modified foods?
I really don't. It's something I decided not to cover in my book because, especially at the time I wrote the book, there were no rules.
It's
So there
changing.
was no sort of fake version. My book is a lot about, people violating the labeling laws, and when there's no labeling laws, there's nothing to violate. Vermont was the first state to pass some standards, but those have since been preempted by the federal government. So, it's still very young. It's up in the air how GMOs are going to shake out.
Well, based on your experience, because this is your industry, why do you think that that was voted down? Do you think that was big business? Do you think, I mean, what do you really think?
Honestly, I've talked to a lot of scientists who really, take the position that there's nothing wrong with GMOs, and they've kind of gotten a bad rap. And if you, I don't want to be put in a position of defending the industry, but the way animals, plants have always been crossbred and hybridized, and when you go to eat beef, it's not typically a cow that's been the way it was, 1,000 years ago. It's been bred. The GMO is sort of a way of, in a lot of cases, of doing that same process in the laboratory. My concern is not so much the genetic modification of foods themselves, but the effect on the environment if it's out of control. Like they just approved the first genetically modified salmon, and they grow faster and bigger than regular salmon. And the concern is if, and they're going to be farmed, if any of these escape in the wild, they're suddenly an invasive species that, endangers the wild salmon. And in every case where they farm fish or other things, these animals have escaped. It's sort of like Jurassic Park, but in real life.
Right, of course. So you think that, I mean, that's a huge issue if that can cross contaminates wild caught salmon, because then the entire industry is contaminated.
It is, but unfortunately, the farm salmon right now, even the non-genetically modified farm salmon, is contaminating the wild salmon.
True, true. So stay away from salmon. What can we eat? My goodness. We haven't covered the Parmesan cheese part, and I do want to cover that. How do we know the ones that are cut with the wood pulp and the cheaper cheeses? How did you find that out? What's some of the evidence behind that?
Well, actually, so my thing is a little bit broader, right? I only want to eat Parmesan cheese that is from Italy, which the reason Parmesan cheese is called Parmesan cheese is because Parmigiano Reggiano comes from Parma. It's a place in Italy. It's where this cheese was invented. It's where the best cheese is still made today. It's known in the industry as the king of cheese. And it's very, Parmigiano Reggiano is made under super strict laws, has been for 800 years, is very unadulterated product. It only has three ingredients in it: milk, salt, and rennet. And the milk has to come from cattle that were reared with no drugs, and they're not allowed to eat anything that was raised with pesticides or fertilizers. It's a super pure food. It's the cheese NASA chose to go into space with the astronauts because it's so pure and nutrient dense. But the producers of Parmesan cheese were unable to get a trademark in the United States for the name Parmesan. So you're allowed in this country to make basically any cheese you want and label it Parmesan. So my issue is not just the grated and the added cellulose, which got a lot of press this year. Inside Edition and Bloomberg, a number of media outlets did investigations of the cellulose or so-called wood pulp being added to the cheese. But that really only affects the grated cheese. For me, I won't even buy a whole wedge of Parmesan cheese unless it's from Italy. But as far as the grated cheese, that's where the cellulose comes in. It's really supposed to be added to the cheese to keep it from clumping. It's an anti-caking agent. If you put a cardboard tube of grated cheese on the shelf and there's moisture and humidity in the air, it's going to solidify. So they add the cellulose to keep that from happening. But the FDA, and this is a good example of the regulation. There's a lot of things that the FDA are, it's what they call recommendations, meaning that they have a policy, but it's not binding. And so their recommendation is that manufacturers use only the amount of cellulose they need to achieve this anti-clumping purpose, which the industry typically is around 2%. But when Inside Edition tested those store brands of Parmesan grated cheese, some of them were over 20%. They had routinely 3, 4, 5, 10 times as much cellulose as you need, and the reality is the reason is because cellulose is cheaper than cheese. So
Yes, yeah.
the more you put in, the more money you make. The solution is really easy. I would never buy grated Parmesan cheese. You only use grated cheese basically to put it on your pasta, put a little on your pizza, add some flavor. So if you just buy a wedge of cheese and take a grater and rub your hand over your food, it's going to take a couple of seconds and it's going to taste better.
That's the
You're going to get a real thing.
best way to do it. But isn't, I mean, I'm going back to the GMO issue, genetically modified organisms are much, much harder to get into Italy, aren't they?
Get into, I'm sorry?
Italy.
Well, I mean, the GMO rules are much tighter in Europe right now. But one of the problems is, and this is it happens with organic as well, especially things like honey, where it's dependent on insects or animals moving around, is all of the seeds, the spores, things become airborne, they move around. As GMOs become more prevalent, there may well come a day when there is no such thing as non-GMO because you cannot keep, and the same problem happens with organic food. You cannot keep everything out of your farm. You could put up, a fence, but that doesn't stop the air.
That is an interesting statement. There may come a day where everything is genetically modified. That's a very good point. Yeah. Now, unless we grow it on our own, but that would still, because of bees and birds and so forth, it could still cross contaminate if there's a genetically modified farm, 5 miles from your house.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot of people who argue right now that there should be no such thing as organic honey, because you cannot control
right.
what your bees go in and what flowers they land on.
Well, I don't know, with the flight of a bee, the travel distance of a bee, I have not done my research on how far a bee can travel, but it would be interesting to find out, because the local area is usually the honey that you should eat. But there's imported honey from France, and there's, you know, in the markets you'll see honey from everywhere. Yeah. It's so there, this is very interesting, because there is not, even if you can control your organic foods and where you shop and even growing your own foods, there's a possibility it can all be genetically modified, and at some point it might be. All right, we are going to take a quick break. We come back with Larry Olmsted about real food versus fake food. We're going to talk a little bit about olive oils and champagne and wines, the good stuff, when we come back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.